First Name Sports starts now.
We're kind of on a first name basis around here.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
Okay, let's get started.
From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
What's going on, America? It's Tuesday afternoon on the Sports Map Radio Network. My name is Greg Frank. Hope everybody's Tuesdays are off to a good start. We're going to try and make them that much better as we kick it from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time every weekday here on the Sports Map Radio Network. And hey, we got some things to talk about. I guess there's always things to talk about. Some days are harder than others. But for a Tuesday with no Stanley Cup final game tonight and no NBA finals game tonight, not too bad. Although we do have last night's Game 2 victory for the Vegas Golden Knights to recap, which we'll get to. But let's start with the bombshell that the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, which is the Euro Tour, and the LIV Golf Tour are merging commercial operations under common ownership. As that news broke this morning, and as I said, bombshell, sure felt like the appropriate term for that news tidbit. I don't profess to be a massive golf fan, very much on the casual viewership side of things with golf. Watch the majors. So, you know, in a lot of ways, while I kind of kept an eye on what was going on, particularly the last 12 to 15 months, I don't profess to watch non-major PGA golf or the LIV Tour. But obviously, like most people, my original takeaway was, having followed this whole feud for the last year and a half, in particular, LIV released a schedule in March of 2022 for an 8-event, 255-million invitational series. And, you know, from that point forward, we started seeing players defect from the PGA Tour. And then in August of last year, we saw the antitrust lawsuit filed against the PGA Tour for unlawful monopoly and restraint of trade from a group of 11 LIV golfers. So it was and then the PGA Tour filed lawsuit against Saudi Arabia's public investment fund. And, you know, it was a messy back and forth, and eventually at this year's PGA Championship, which was about a month ago now, Rory McIlroy had basically just said that he had had enough, like he wasn't ready to answer any more questions about the ongoing LIV PGA feud. Of course, Brooks Koepka won the PGA Championship, a LIV Golf member, a few weeks ago, and now we have this partnership, which ends the, you know, ongoing litigation between the governing bodies. And I think through it all, clearly the loser is Jay Monahan, who I'm sure comes out clean financially in all of this. But how does anybody on the PGA Tour take this guy seriously? Anybody on any tour? Because he was trying to kind of take the moral high ground all of last year. And, oh, we're not going to take that Saudi Arabia money and all the, you know, the sport washing term that we heard a lot. And it was like the LIV guys that were going, they were the bad guys. And the PGA, you know, loyalists were the men of good faith and the men of high morals. And what did that get the, I'm sure a lot of PGAers are thinking, well, what did that really get me? I'm a good guy. But I turned down all this money that I was being offered. Meanwhile, a lot of the big names that Liv got, Brooks Koepka, Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, probably feel very much vindicated through all of this. And I just wonder what happened. Like, what happened behind closed doors? How did we get here? How much did the PGA, high-profile guys, like a Rory McIlroy, who was one of the, more outspoken PGAers in the fight, how much did they know about what was going on? Because I'm sure maybe a Rory McIlroy or somebody else that, was a big name might have known some things. But when this just drops on us and, certainly the lesser of a name you were on the PGA Tour, I think the less likely you were to have been in the know. And then I question how much the high up guys were in terms of in the know and their profile and the higher prize earning guys for their careers. So when you listen to Jay Monahan, we have a cut from last year, almost exactly a year ago, in June of 2022. I forget the event that he was talking at. But I go back to that moral high ground kind of pedestal that the PGA was propping itself up on. And think, well, what did it really mean? Other than you could just say you were a good guy. This was Monahan last year in June talking about, how much it would mean to still be a member of the PGA Tour.
Well, I talked to players. I've talked at a player meeting, and I've talked to a number of players individually for a long period of time. And I think you'd have to be living under a rock to not know that there are significant implications. And as it relates to the families of 9/11, I have two families that are close to me that lost loved ones. And so my heart goes out to them. And I would ask, any player that has left or any player that would ever consider leaving, have you ever had to apologize for being a member of the PGA Tour?
And that's the moral kind of superiority that he's trying to imply there. Have you ever had to apologize for being a member of the PGA Tour? No, I guess they didn't have to until now when it's like, I've had to maybe apologize to my family for not having as much money as I could have. Or, that's where I just think about the leadership here and wonder how many people who were on the fence as to what to do and maybe stayed with the PGA were left in the dark and why they should trust this guy. So he comes across as the villain in all of this. And now all of a sudden the Liv guys kind of feel like, hey, enough with making us the villains. Because maybe we were onto something the whole time. Mike Lupica, who's a big time author, columnist for the New York Daily News, tweets, maybe not today, but Jay Monahan is through. No matter how much money is about to change hands, he just turned into everything he said he hated. Someday they'll name a figure skating move after him. And I don't know how you can come down on any other conclusion other than Jay Monahan did a complete 180. And I mentioned we played that clip from June of 2022. I'm sure there are plenty of other clips from what he said from the last year that we can listen back on and be like, yo, that's the same person? That's the same guy that engineered this merger? Or at least played an integral role in getting it over the finish line? I'll tell you, you hear all this stuff and you think, well, like sometimes it's more of a cliche when we say, well, that would make a good soap opera or sport reality, sports are the great, the NBA is the best reality TV out there with some of the player beefs and things that happen in off seasons and stuff like that. Well, we legitimately have that with golf because the Netflix Full Swing series, which launched this year, its first season, back in March, they opted to move forward with a second season, and the producer of the show tweeted today, you better believe we were filming when this broke. So, and I know Belmer said he has the guy's number, so hopefully we'll be able to get him on at some point, maybe when things slow down in the summer, and just get a little bit of an insight into what he can disclose as to what the second season is going to look like. I haven't watched the first season, but I probably will before the second season comes out, because the second season just got a whole lot juicier. And gosh, the U.S. Open is next week, and this deserves to be a top story. You know, like people will say, oh, this is a distraction to the tournament. Well, you can blame Jay Monahan for that. And I hope that there are some PGA players that really open up next week about what they did and didn't know. Let's go to the ice as the Vegas Golden Knights win 7-2 last night over the Florida Panthers, and they take a 2-0 lead in the Stanley Cup Final. We'll discuss First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.
With First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
Vegas 7, Florida 2. That's the score in last night's Stanley Cup Final Game 2. And gosh, I think that it's always a bummer when we get lopsided championship rounds in pro sports, because most of the people watching aren't fans of the two teams and are probably just hoping for one last competitive fight to conclude the season. But when you watch certainly the last four periods, all three last night and the third period on Saturday in game one, it just doesn't seem like a fair fight. Vegas jumps out 2-0 very quickly on Florida in game two on home ice last night and never looks back. 2-0 series lead. And the big thing that I highlighted on, what, Friday, I guess it was, when we were finishing up for the week, previewing the Stanley Cup Final, was the one player who is going to make or break the entire outcome of this Stanley Cup Final is Sergei Bobrovsky for his team. And certainly looking like he's breaking it with the way he's played. And I think collectively, Vegas just imposing its will, not really fazed by the fact that this guy has been playing so well. I think that's something that, particularly in the later rounds of the playoffs, you have to fight against, is that awe factor, that wow factor of, wow, like, look at Bobrovsky, he's stopping everything, and Matthew Tkachuk, and being able to kind of respect the skill sets of these players, but also know how to minimize them. And I think that's what we've seen from Vegas, is I don't think all of these goals are softies from Bobrovsky. He got ran from the game last night. And by the way, I don't read into that. Dallas did the same thing in different times of the Western Conference Final with Jake Oettinger, and it might have even happened in the conference semifinal round against Seattle, where it's a playoff hockey thing. You pull the goalie to try and light a fire under your team to try and say, hey, like, everybody needs to wake up. It's just the easiest one change you can make in a game is if your hockey team is let's pull our goalie. So Bob will be in there on Thursday night in game three, and Florida obviously needs a big response. But they have thrown, Vegas has thrown everything at Bobrovsky and really knocked him out of his element. And that's why they've outscored Florida 12-4 in this series. And simply put, if Vegas has given up 12 goals in two games, and they give up 12 more goals the next two games, this series is a sweep. Or excuse me, if Florida's given up 12 more goals in the next two games. Because Florida has really done a good job at mastering the same path to success in these playoffs. Good in their own end. We're getting good goaltending, and we're going to get timely scoring. Matthew Tkachuk's going to pop goals in at the perfect times, and, you know, Carter Verhaeghe at times, whoever, right? Brandon Montour. But that only works when the game's 1-1 after two periods, when the game's 2-1 after two periods. When you start to get into a higher-paced, faster game, and when you start to play too much time in your own end, even if you've played well in your own end for most of these playoffs, as the Cats have to get to this point, you're going to have to turn the tide. And if you just rely so much on how good you are in your own end, then you're going to be spending too much time in your own end. And if you spend too much time in your own end, eventually the puck is going to end up in your own net. And I think, while it's nothing against Toronto, who was the opponent for Florida in the second round, certainly Boston maybe was a little bit tight. And I don't think that Carolina is as good as Vegas. So the point I'm making is I think this Vegas team can come at opponents in waves with a lot of depth, but also high-end players that show up in these big moments, because that's been a big problem, particularly for Toronto, is that guys like Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner have just come and gone too much, up and down, ebb and flow in playoff series. Whereas you look at the Vegas stat sheet every night, Jonathan Marchessault scores again. Jack Eichel has another assist. Mark Stone's doing something. And when your best players routinely show up, and you have a lot of them, in a sport like hockey where you got to, as I said, have to have that depth where you can roll three lines confidently, when you can put four defensemen on the ice that you feel really good about at the very least, then you're going to win because your depth is better and that depth just kind of wears down the other team, which in this case is Florida, who I just don't think is able to transition well enough, able to, you know, like they got, Florida has four goals and one of them was just a wraparound shorthanded goal from Eric Staal in the first game. And you know, that's a great individual play by him. And I believe the Duclair goal was unassisted off of faceoff in the first game. You know, and last night you look, I mean, you know, can't really read anything into Florida's goals. The game was already over by the time Florida got on the board. Like, they're not doing enough. They don't strike enough fear into other teams with the way they can play in the offensive zone and with the players that they, Eric Staal's how old now? I mean, and I think that's the problem. Vegas, like, they just look ready to win the thing. All their guys, for the most part, are guys in their primes. In the case of Marchessault and Riley Smith, talked a little bit about it yesterday, guys that Florida aided Vegas immensely in acquiring in the expansion draft in 2017 that have been there and grown, you know, as players with the Knights, and guys like Mark Stone and Jack Eichel that haven't won the cup, but, you know, kind of are sensing that this is a great time to do so. And then you have, you know, different guys like Alex Pietrangelo who have won cups. And it's all coming together for Vegas, and Florida just appears to be a little bit out of gas, maybe. They get 2 days off, going back home. There's that old adage, playoff series don't start until you win a game at, or you lose a game at home, you know, until the road team wins one. So, you know, maybe we're sitting, I highly doubt we are, but maybe we're sitting here in 6 days on Monday. Talking about a 2-2 Stanley Cup final headed back to Vegas. I just can't see it right now. This looks like men amongst boys. This looks like the Florida Panthers, who now are very much showing why they were an 8 seed. And this looks like a Vegas Golden Knights team that was, I believe, second in the Western Conference overall and has been a playoff juggernaut for their entire existence, really. And now it's time for them to win the thing. What am I missing here? Marchessault, I believe, has to be the Conn Smythe Trophy winner at this point, because it's every game he shows up and scores a big goal, usually early in games that get Vegas going. He had a natural hat trick in the closeout game against the Edmonton Oilers. And I don't know what the, like, it's going to take a serious rabbit pulled out of the hat for Florida to get back in this thing. Because right now, and I also think, I mentioned the last four periods. This all started with the third period of game one. Where, because at the end of the second period, Anthony Duclair gets a goal, and this thing is 2-2, going to the third, and you're thinking, hey, Florida, if we're Florida, we just tied the game up in the final 10 seconds of the second period. Win a period, we steal game one. We've already accomplished our mission of winning one of the two in Vegas. Instead, Vegas gets three. Mark Stone, we talked about it yesterday, makes that great hand-eye coordination play in the offensive zone, scores a goal to put Vegas up 4-2. Riley Smith gets an empty netter. They win 5-2. And then last night's just one-way traffic. And if you're Florida, I think that has to feel very deflating. I think if you're the Panthers, you have to look at things and say, it's gut check time. What do we have in our room? And you know what? Hey, this is the same Panthers team, if you're looking for optimism, that came back from 3-1 against the historic Boston Bruins in the first round. So I'm sure that part of them saying, hey, 3-1 against Boston, why can't we do 2-0 against Vegas and come back again? But they're going to have to really see the narrative turned for the better because outscored 12-4 last night's a blowout, really, from start to finish. Not looking good for the Florida Panthers. John Michaels from 6-8 to the Fan joins. We talked about some of the big baseball series getting started early in the week. How about the Atlanta Braves and the New York Mets? They start 3 games in Atlanta. We'll talk with John on the other side.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, we go out to the Progressive Guest Line as, you know, before we had this news with the LIV Golf Tour merging with the PGA and the Euro Tour, we kind of had a feeling we'd start dipping our toes more in the baseball waters, finding some good series to preview. And, that obviously we had to book our guest to do so today, and it is still a pretty good series in Atlanta, so we bring on John Michaels from 680 The Fan down there in the ATL to talk more about Braves and Mets, 3 games tonight in Georgia. John, thank you for your time. How are you?
Doing great. Anytime. Obviously a huge series here in the ATL. It's the stinking Mets come to town.
Before we talk about what happened, or what will happen these next 3 nights, what'd you make of the Marcell Ozuna stuff over the weekend?
You know, I don't want to come across as hypocritical. I'm, sitting there in my basement watching the game, and I see him hit the ball, and I go, he's only going to get a single out of this if this doesn't go out of the park. I just
you said it.
When the ball left the park or left the yard, and it didn't leave the yard, just a couple of inches short. But where I don't want to be hypocritical, a few years ago, Ronald Acuna had the exact same thing on a ball hit down the right field line that looked like a home run and ended up not being a home run, and he got a single, and the Braves ended up not scoring a run. All for me was washed away when Eddie Rosario hit a grand slam in the ninth inning for the win. Had the Braves lost that game 5-4, Marcell Ozuna really is going to be a guy that's looked at even worse than he is sometimes for his production at the plate, because you would have lost a one-run game. You would have lost the series 2-1. You'd only have a 2-game lead over the Miami Marlins. But for me, I think Brian Snitker handled it the right way. Pulled him out of the game. We were at Austin Riley's golf tournament yesterday. Had a chance to ask Austin face-to-face How did the club handle it? How did Marcelo handle it behind closed doors? Ozuna said, look, my bad. It's my own fault. It won't happen again. And Austin Riley told us point blank, the team's moving on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was feels like something where you just have to, if you're Snitker, you just have to send a message and turn the page, right?
Yeah, that's it. And Ozuna's been so hot at the plate over the last month. I mean, we had him cut on our show back in mid-April. It was like, all right, as soon as they can cut him and they want to eat $16 million bucks a year, get him out of here. Well, then he's hit over 300 in the month of May, hit 7 or 8 home runs, had 30 runs driven in, and you suddenly feel like, okay, this guy can be part of the lineup. So, yeah, it's a one-day deal. And, again, the win made it a hell of a lot easier to fly back across from the West Coast.
All right, as we move forward and talk about this series with the Mets, obviously I think New York, much like the Phillies and the Padres, you've had a lot of teams that weren't the Braves that were in the playoffs last year that have been off to slow starts in 2023. What do you make of how the Mets and Braves match up? Did you think all along that we were going to be in for a fight to the bitter end with these two teams in the NL East like we had last year? Just your thoughts on kind of where we are right now with these two teams in the division.
You know, the Mets, obviously, at the top of their rotation have just studs. Mm-hmm. And if those guys stay healthy, they're obviously going to be a group that sticks around and will make a run. Their bats have been really cold so far this year, which is a little bit surprising, 60 games into the season. And the fact that they're in third place is surprising. But one of the things I learned a lot last year, remember when that Sal Licata nitwit up in New York decided to say the NL East was over on May 31st, and the Braves at that time, I think, were 10.5 games back and felt like they were dead and gone. These two teams are going to be there till the end. I also think the Mets, they're going to be one of those teams that eventually says, okay, we got to go make trades, and we're going to mortgage whatever we need to try to go out and get back into a playoff mix. So I'd like to see the Braves over these next 3 days put some more distance between themselves and the Mets, because there's going to be a time when the Mets' bats get hot. There's going to be a time when their pitching becomes completely dominant, and I think they will make a run at some point.
Okay. I having said that, though, I mean, you make a good point about the distance right now, and I know it is still just early June, but it is a 6-game lead in the loss column for Atlanta on the Mets. I don't think anybody really looks at Miami as a team that is going to manage to continue to win all these close games that the Marlins have won. So, you know, if we're saying it's the Mets and, you know, the Phillies, at least the last couple days have played a little bit better. If we're saying it's those two teams that Atlanta is competing with for the division crown, well, they already have a sizable lead right now. So I think pretty important here for the Mets to at least keep their distance, right?
Absolutely. You think about it, simple terms of math. If the Braves win 2 out of 3 this week at home, it's a 6.5 game lead over the Mets. If they somehow sweep, you're talking about an 8.5 game lead over the Mets. And the Braves eventually are going to get healthy. You know, a lot of folks around the country are probably looking to go, oh, this is just the same Atlanta team we've seen in years past. 21-game winner Kyle Wright from a year ago has been out most of the year. Mm-hmm. He won't be back until July or August. Last year's runner-up to the Cy Young, Max Fried, he's also been out. He's looking at, and he was just transferred to the 60-day injured, which wasn't really a surprise. It was just more a logistical thing yesterday. He'll be back sometime in July. So you're talking about two power arms that potentially could be back in the rotation in July, which is only going to bolster what this team is. They've dealt with Michael Harris being hurt for stretches of the year, and he's been a shell of himself where he was a year ago when he was the co-rookie of the year in the National League. If he can start hitting again, this lineup's going to be even more potent. They dealt with Travis d'Arnaud being out for a while with injury. So my point to that is when the Braves get healthy, it's almost going to be like all-star deadline deals where you're going to get great pitching coming back. And that's why I think for teams around the league, whether it's the Marlins, the Mets, the Phillies, they better keep it close, or the Braves are going to be a team that's really, really tough to deal with.
You know, I just looked this up. Only 4 times has the 2 of the 3 major BBWAA awards, Rookie of the Year, MVP, and Cy Young, been from the same team. Could we be looking at that with Spencer Strider and Ronald Acuna Jr. this year?
Yeah, Acuna to me has, and I don't want to say running away, again, it's early June, but Acuna is putting together – he's on pace right now for like 35 homers and 60 stolen bases, which is absolutely insane. And he's playing a great right field. You know, you're talking about a guy now almost 2 years removed from that devastating ACL injury.
Yeah.
And he looks like the Acuna we had a year ago. And Spencer Strider leading the National League in strikeouts. This is a 10-strikeout machine, Strider is. My only fear for him is maybe the name recognition isn't there when you get down somewhere later into the voting process. But Spencer's putting together an unbelievable year. And the crazy part, the guy that's pitching tonight for him, Bryce Elder, I guarantee most people couldn't pick him out of a lineup. Hell, I probably couldn't without his jersey on. He's leading the National League in ERA. Coming out of spring training, he was a Triple-A guy.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, he's pitching his butt off. So Alex Anthopoulos has done a great job unearthing a bunch of different
people. Oh, their whole developmental staff, they just always have more pitching.
Yep, and they've got one. Watch the next time through the rotation. They sent Mike Soroka back down to Triple-A. Mm-hmm. He was struggling with a sinker ball. They've got a young kid named A.J. Smith-Shawver. He just made his major league debut over the weekend against Arizona. 2 1/3 in relief, 3 strikeouts, no runs. I think he walked one. He will probably get the start the next time through. This was electric. I mean, you're talking about less than 100 games total in the minor leagues, comes flying up through the league, now in the rotation, potentially in the next start. That could be the next one you look at and go, where the hell they find this guy?
All right, John, before we let you go, I know you're a Miami guy. How are you feeling? 1-1 in the NBA Finals, head back to South Beach.
Well, I picked the Heat in 7. I'm not changing. The Heat are going to win this series. They're better coached, not by much, and maybe to the dismay of Ramona Shelburne, who asked a great question yesterday, and Eric Spoelstra shot it down. Find a way to get not let the others beat you. You cannot let Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Michael Porter and all those guys get open threes. If Miami shoots it well, they're going to win an NBA championship, and I'll tell you, it'll be the most unlikely championship potentially in sports history.
You think we see Tyler Hero in one of these two games in Miami?
I hope so, but just reading everything, and Barry Jackson of the Miami Herald maybe an hour ago said he's still not cleared by the medical staff. They said yesterday he's still dealing with soreness after a shoot-around. I just don't know if you're dealing with that. Can you put him back in the game? I hope you can, because I think there's time in this series you're going to need somebody that can give you some buckets, not named Jimmy Butler or Gabe Vincent, maybe Bam Adebayo. But I'd love to see Tyler back. I just reading the tea leaves, I don't think he's going to be back in the 7-game series.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like if it doesn't happen tomorrow or in game 4, then the later we get in the series, the less likely it would be that it would happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, it sucks. You know, 2 years in a row, this poor kid has been hurt in the playoffs. Last year in the Boston series, he hurt a groin and was really ineffective or couldn't play. Now you're talking about breaking a hand in game 1 of the playoffs, diving for a loose ball, and he's been sitting out the whole year. But it's worked out for the Heat. I'll tell you, other guys have stepped up. Duncan Robinson, he's earned that contract in these 20 games throughout the playoffs.
All right, there he is, John Michaels from 680 The Fan in Atlanta, kind enough to join us to talk a little Braves and Mets beginning tonight at Truist Park, and, of course, the Miami Heat trying to win what is now a best of 5 in the NBA Finals. John, thank you for your time, and enjoy the rest of your week.
Yeah, you as well.
All right. We'll take a timeout, and we will come back. Another guest on the other side, Ryan Ballingy. Had to get a golf guy on in light of the LIV Golf News. Ryan Ballingy will join the show, the owner of Golf News Net. Had to get this perspective on today, so it's coming for you on the other side. First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.
Back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
Okay, let's continue with the LIV PGA merger talk as we bring on Ryan Ballingy, the owner of Golf News Net, joining us now. Ryan, thank you for your time. How you doing? I'm sure it's a crazy day.
Wildest day of my career, that's for darn sure.
All right, well, let's just start there. On a personal and professional level for you, what's the day been like?
It's been weird. I mean, I got the news about this just as everyone did at the same time. This was probably the best-kept secret in golf history, at least as it relates to business. Golf's notoriously bad at keeping secrets, so even stuff that might seem surprising, some people have an inkling about in the sport. This was out of nowhere, and it's pretty amazing that that happened. And then all of a sudden to go from thinking about we're going to be thinking about the Canadian Open this week to a fundamental shift in the way golf works, it's absolutely stunning.
I know we're still obviously all, I think, trying to gather information here, but do you have any kind of educated guesses as to how we got to today?
Oh, I have hundreds of questions, but I guess my reading of the tea leaves on this is, I kind of tweeted about this, so I don't want to repeat myself too much, but the Saudis, through the Public Investment Fund and LIV, were about to get involved in discovery in a lawsuit against the PGA Tour and the countersuit from the PGA Tour against them. And I'm sure they didn't want any part of that. That would open the books to the Public Investment Fund, what they've invested, how much they've got, a lot of stuff the Saudis don't want public. At the same time, the PGA Tour didn't want to get involved in the discovery side of their end of the case either, because that would mean opening up the books, explaining where their money comes from, how much goes out to the players, and a whole bunch of stuff that might otherwise be potentially embarrassing. Mm. LIV's not working as a business model. Very few people watch it. It has very little public support. The events are kind of seen as a joke. The PGA Tour has had a really hard time keeping up financially with the money that the Saudis have been able to throw at this, the billions they've already thrown at LIV Golf. They're reaching out to sponsors to ask them to pay 8 digits more per year in money so that they can sponsor these designated purses for $20 million. That's been a tremendous struggle, while at the same trying to maintain these longtime sponsors who are being asked to take on a reduced role as non-designated events. That wasn't working. So it seems to me like this was one big loss mitigation strategy, and throwing the DP World Tour with it because they've been struggling, caught in the middle of this as well. So no one was winning, so they all decided to kind of lose together.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. If you're a PGA Tour player that was a loyalist to the tour the last 15 months or so, going back to when this feud really began, how do you look Jay Monahan with a straight face ever again?
I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I don't see how Monahan survives this in the long haul, even though he has effectively appointed himself the CEO of golf, because he is now the commissioner of the PGA Tour and the CEO of this entity that is coming along that will manage the assets of PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and LIV. And I don't know how these players that stuck their necks and chests out to speak up in behalf of the PGA Tour, to stay loyal to the concept, to not take some chunk of the billions of dollars on offer to them from LIV, and trust him ever again with anything he says. The only way this works, really, and I know there's been some pushback on this, but is if the Saudis effectively say, we will pay you some chunk of money as kind of a smoothing over of relations between LIV and the PGA Tour. Because otherwise, for the rest of their careers, these players, and they're great players, are going to hold some financial animosity toward the players that went to LIV and are now probably going to be welcomed back largely with open arms.
Right. Okay, so what's the vibe going to be like at the U.S. Open next week?
Oh, my God, I can't wait. As someone who is in the content game, the content is going to be amazing, right? I go back to the old Darren Revelle tweet. This is a horrible situation, but the content is amazing. I am very curious to see what the reaction will be from all the players congregated. I mean, LIV hasn't had an event for a few weeks. They're going to have the remaining 7 or 8 this year. They're going to be, a number of them are going to be there. I'm sure Phil Mickelson will be smiling ear to ear and be almost unlistenable at times.
Yeah.
But I want to hear from Rory McIlroy and Jon Rahm, and Tiger won't be there. I'd love to hear from him. Obviously, I want to hear from Phil and Bryson and Brooks. Those guys obviously feel quite vindicated in terms of their decision-making and where all of this goes from here, because for the majors, really nothing's going to change, but everything else is, and that's a lot to work out.
Yeah, no, you're right. And when you say that there's a lot to be worked out still, what's your guess as to where we go from here now that we have this bombshell news?
Man, I could see so many different ways this goes. There could be the formation of a live-like league where you have teams and you have 48 players and you are playing for these enormous purses every week. And then the top players just play the majors on top of those. I could see that. I could see something that looks a lot like the way the PGA Tour has looked forever. And you just have more money across the board for everybody. That could be a thing. The DP World Tour is going to probably be a winner in this, and that they're probably going to be able to have more money at their events. And they're going to be able to have probably more access to hosting some of these types of events on an international scale. I imagine there's going to be golf in Saudi Arabia on the PGA Tour. You have to imagine that's part of it. So what does that mean for the tours like the Asian Tour that the Saudis agreed to invest $300 million over 10 years? Is that up in smoke? Are they done? Who knows? What happens to the tours that are affiliated with the DP World Tour, Sunshine Tour, the Australasian Tour? I mean, they have relationships too. They're not included in this deal. What happens to the PGA Tour's infrastructure of the Korn Ferry Tour and the PGA Tour Americas? How does that all work with the DP World Tour? I mean, there's quite literally 100 questions that I have, and I don't think anybody involved actually has the answers to any of them yet. Yeah. They've just kind of decided, we're going to get in bed together and then figure out the rest.
Yeah.
Shotgun wedding, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of meat on the bone there, and you know, we'll have to kind of see how it all gets sorted out. Do you like, in terms of the media availability here, you talk about, obviously we'll hear from the players at the U.S. Open, and that's going to be fun for the content game, as you said. How much are we going to hear from Jay Monahan?
I'm very curious about that, because he is going to take a public drumming for a long time. For everything that he said, I mean, a year ago at this tournament, the RBC Canadian Open, he went in the booth on CBS and talked about 9/11, invoked 9/11 and the Saudis. He talked about how PGA Tour players never had to be ashamed of being a PGA Tour member or explain why they are. He talked about playing for legacy, not for leverage, for history, not for money. All of that stuff that has come out of his mouth in the last year plus now looks absolutely hypocritical. And I don't know how in good conscience he can talk out of both sides of his mouth now moving forward to try to work his way back to a single track of this is the way the PGA Tour is going to be moving forward. I don't care what explanation he can offer, how nuanced it could be. It makes him look bad. And frankly, that's the reason why I think he can't survive this all that long.
All right, Ryan, last one. I think one of the more screwed up things that we talk about with Monahan is the, you know, seemingly kind of weaponizing those 9/11 families. And then turning around and doing this, like, as much as we talk about how the players can't take them seriously, I mean, this was a, you know, obviously a massive national tragedy that we saw a bunch of lives lost. And he tried to kind of use it as a way to make the PGA Tour look like the good guys. And here we are a year later.
Yeah, I mean, I visited the 9/11 Memorial in New York. Just a couple weeks ago, I went to the Flight 93 Memorial for the first time. Very moving,
powerful. I've been to that in Shanksville, yeah.
Sad experiences. Really takes you back to that day and the unimaginable tragedies people went through on that day. And to have Monahan invoke that and to kind of perpetuate that sadness in through golf to try to create leverage against the Saudis. And I'll throw in Jimmy Dunn in this as well, who lost countless numbers of employees through 9/11. Has been a power broker in golf, is on the PGA Tour's board, and apparently has been somewhat instrumental in putting this together. That frankly disgusts me. I don't care where you come down on whether you cared that the Saudis invested in golf or live. The invocation of a national tragedy to create that situation where we ultimately are today is just incomprehensible to me.
There he is, Ryan Ballingy, the owner of Golf News Net, on a very busy day and historic day in golf. Ryan, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
All right. We'll take a timeout, and we'll come back halfway home on a Tuesday afternoon. Got a little story from my Monday night to share. That's next.